Kentucky Bikes is tapping into a matching federal fund program to expand its bike stations this summer. Bike Share Hawaii runs the Honolulu-based bike rental program, and Executive Director Lori McCarney wants your input on where some of those new stations should go.
What we want to do is create a large list of places that are possible, then take those out to the community, let the community help us vet those locations, and then be able to, with confidence, go ahead and order the equipment and roll it out.
Okay. And so how different will this be compared to the initial rollout a year ago?
So what will be different right now is that people will know what we're talking about. It was very difficult to get people's attention last time because it was sort of like, what are you talking about? So now we know that people know what a Beaky Stop is. And so if they think it, this is going to be positive or it's going to be negative, we have the chance to talk to them about that specifically and not spend all of our time trying to explain what a bike share system is.
Okay, so where are the locations that you're looking? What are the parameters?
Yeah, so the areas that we're looking at right now are just taking our current service area, which is from Chinatown to Diamond Head, and then expanding around the edges, some of the places that we haven't reached. So Ivalei, for example, if you've been in that area, you'll see that there's new bike infrastructure around there, and there's some great destinations, including Dole Cannery. There's a lot of offices in there, too. So that's one area that we're looking at. We're also looking at Makiki. Makiki feeds downtown. There's just a lot of density, a lot of apartments up there, and it feeds downtown and also feeds UH. So UH is the other. We are looking and finalizing our agreement with UH to have 5 to 6 Beaky Stops at UH Manoa. And then I should have mentioned in Ivalei, also at Hawaii Community College.
And so initially, I think when we last talked, you said, UH has some issues with hills, and you weren't sure if, you know, the folks were going to make the trek down, but maybe wouldn't bicycle back up to Manoa.
Well, yeah, we still may run into that. Part of putting it up there is also them providing the density to have the station, the paths to the station, so it's not just one station in an area. So how we address that is the station density. When people say, why do you have so many stations in this area? It's exactly for something like that. If we had one station at UH Manoa, it could be very difficult because we couldn't keep the bikes in and out if in fact everybody rode downhill and not uphill. But if we have a number of stations, then it's something we can more readily manage.
Okay. And then any other challenges that you foresee in expanding to these particular areas?
Yes, the same challenges that we had before. The challenges being that our preference is to put a Beaky Stop on wide sidewalks, and not, you know, have enough space so that we clear ADA requirements. If we can't do that, then going into restricted parking spaces, and we learned about restricted parking doesn't mean that people don't park there. And then parking spaces as a last resort. Private properties, we're also pursuing private property agreements. So in those situations, I think We definitely have gotten a lot of requests for stations in different areas. And so the tough balance is balancing the needs of the people for parking cars when we know parking is tight, but also then meeting the needs of people who want to use an alternative mode of transportation and providing that to them.
And then did you make any changes to the sites that you rolled out initially? Did you, let's say, give up some more of the parking spaces, or give it back, I should say?
Initially, it was very difficult. The conversations were hard, and people said, boy, Lori is so stubborn and, you know, doesn't want to change anything. And the point was just to try to give them a chance to be able to build their ridership. And so we see in a lot of the spaces where there was some question about them that their usage is really high. And so if it was, let's say if we took 2 parking spaces and on average that parking space, you know how people will camp out in a parking space? We're able to actually then with 15 docks see people go in many, many different times of day, so we can serve more people in that area. So one of the things that we've gained is people who support it, who use it, and are ready to stand up and say, I don't want to lose that Beaky Stop because I depend on it.
And what about the issues that you faced over at Kapi'olani Park? Do you see that getting ironed out where you might be able to put Biki bike stops there, or is that just kind of in limbo for a while?
Well, that's something that we're trying to determine. Is we know that there's a difference of opinion about what Biki is to different folks there, but we also know that we see it as transportation. That's how it's being used. 65% of our 65% of our riders are residents, and in Kapi'olani Park, right now, since there's no locations, Biki stop locations in Kapi'olani Park, residents can't really use it to go to Kaimana Beach or go to the tennis courts or, you know, or go to the Shell, right? Because there's no place to dock the bike. So we've had a lot of requests for Kapi'olani Park, and so we're having discussions with various people right now to see if we can serve it.
Does it have to go to court to get ironed out or not?
No, it doesn't have to go to court to get ironed out. It's really, I believe it's a matter of people coming together and determining what the right course of action is.
You mentioned that 65% of your riders are residents. I think a lot of folks initially thought that more tourists were going to take it.
Yeah, and I know when I ride Biki, they think I'm a tourist. And I think that's one of the things that's hard to tell. But because I live downtown, I see a different ridership than somebody who may live in another neighborhood. So I think it's one of those things. So it's not our members, it's of the rides, which is what we thought. So from rides, for example, I ride 2 to 4 to 6 to 8 times a day on Biki. So I'm taking a lot of trips. I'm using it for those short trips. And so out of those rides, we know the use is mostly residents.
What about the money aspect of it? If it's more expensive for the tourists because they're more likely to just walk up rather than get the passes, how are we doing that? Does it pencil out?
Yeah, well, you know, we haven't really found it. We're a nonprofit, and it's really confusing for people because I know that they've told me, wow, we see so many people riding, you must be making a lot of money. Well, that's not the case. Because we have more residents riding and because we designed our pricing to be affordable, $15 a month is unlimited rides for a month. And so for me, if I take 50 rides in a month, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm still paying $15. So that's fine. Donations and support is very important to us from the standpoint of our financial sustainability. And then the other thing is the fare revenue covers operational cost, maybe, you know, getting close. And so we want to have high quality operations. We want to have safe bikes. We want to have them clean. We want to have the technology and the call center and all of those kinds of things. So that's coming along. It's not fully covering, but as we're seeing more ridership, then we expect that it will.
Okay. And then the issue of whether you'll be able to get more donors. I know there was a question as to whether the little signs you had on there was advertising or not. And I know at the time you talked about, well, we could have sold advertising at the Biki stops, but you thought that might be a little bit much based on our laws, our billboard laws.
Yeah, signage laws here do not allow us to do any advertising and on the stations. And I still see that our the support that's shown on our bikes really supports sponsors. So we're asking for a major donation from top companies, and we're holding that to 5 companies. My personal thought is that we don't want them to be billboards. We want to demonstrate the business community's support for Biki, and that's one way to do it, is limit it to 5 companies and let them really leverage that into their employee bases, into the things that they do for health or sustainability reasons or what have you.
Okay. And then as far as theft, or, you know, what are the issues that you folks, what have you learned since you've been in business?
Yeah, so we learned some interesting things, that a lost bike is not necessarily a lost forever bike. We've had calls that, you know, bikes found in lost and founds, and or calls to go pick up a bike somewhere. So out of our 1,000 bikes, we're like, it's a point in time thing because they're not lost forever. So I know at the end of the year, there were 6 bikes that were missing. And so out of 1,000, that's pretty darn good, and I bet that they'll show up again.
Lori McCarney is the executive director of Bike Share Hawaii, which operates the Biki bike sharing service in Honolulu. The program launched in the summer of 2017 and will expand with new Beaky Stops this summer. For links on how to weigh in, you can check the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, photography as a Zen practice, but first, your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a bird that's native to the Hawaiian Islands, but has seen severe population decline through the years. It was once found on all the islands, but is now confined to Oahu and Kauai. Oahu residents might have seen them around in Kauai Nui Marsh. It's about the size of a chicken, mostly black in color, and although it's a water bird, it doesn't have webbed feet. Instead, it has long toes, a bit like storks, and the feature that gives it away, though, is its bright red frontal shield. You can find them in wetlands, low-elevation streams, and taro fields, but they tend to shy away from human contact. Today, we're looking for their English and Hawaiian names. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
The art of photography calls for immersion in the moment. What is it about that instant of time that makes you want to preserve it? David Ulrich has been teaching photography for decades and sees the quest for that immersion as a kind of spiritual practice. His new book is called Zen Camera, Creative Awakening with a Daily Practice in Photography, and he's with us in our studio. David, thanks so much for coming in.
Chris, thank you for having me.
You've really integrated photography into every aspect of your life, thanks to the portable cell phone camera.
Well, for me, the cell phone camera is a natural extension of what I do and what we do as photographers, because the camera is with me always.
Yeah.
Which means that as I walk around the world and I want to interact with something more deeply or more intensely, I can pull out my camera. And I use it for a process of sketching.
And then maybe go back or revisit it with a real camera?
Maybe go back and revisit it. But I don't want to say with a real camera, because a cell phone camera is also a real camera.
Well, that's...
We say revisit it with a bigger camera.
Bigger camera, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm reflecting my photographer's disdain for the cell phone camera, which I'm trying to get over, because I can really see your point about its usefulness.
It's interesting. My publisher released two books on the same day. The first book was titled How to Break Up with Your Phone.
Right.
And my book is, of course, titled Zen Camera. So I'm promoting the use of the phone to bring you more fully into the moment, to interact more deeply with the world and, by extension, with yourself, really looking at mindfully your own responses to the world.
Well, because it isn't just a matter of having a camera in your pocket. You have to adapt to a way of thinking. That's what you're saying.
I think that some of the precepts of Zen are very important to photography. In photography, we're asked to have a dual attention, a mindful attention, where we're paying attention to the world, but we really have to pay attention to our own inward responses.
Yeah.
Our responses to the world don't take place out there. And so the camera becomes an intermediary between the inner and the outer world, so to speak.
And now that interaction with the machine has been made so intuitive, you don't have those intermediate, you know, shutter speed, f-stop stages.
That's a good thing and that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
I think on the one hand, there's an unselfconscious, spontaneous charm from the many pictures people take with a cell phone. But on the other side of the equation, a designer friend of mine has called it visual pollution.
Mm-hmm.
So part of my intent in the book is to give people a basic teaching in the language of photography so that they can actually become better photographers. Laszlo Moholy-Nagy said in 1934, he was the head of the Bauhaus, he said, "The illiterate of the future will be ignorant of the pen and camera alike." So I'm trying to offer some visual literacy for people that haven't had an education in photography.
There's a phrase that jumped out at me from the book, and this is relating photography to the paintings made by Zen masters who painted with the, this is a quote, who painted with the surety of spontaneous gesture born out of attention.
Born out of attention.
Born out of attention.
You know, when
and yet spontaneous, right? So
right.
Not locked by some mode of thinking.
Well, it's fluid.
Yeah.
Ideally, in photography, we try to move beyond our preconceptions, even, if you will, move beyond our ideologies, because we may see a moment where there's a clash between what we think and feel and what is actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there needs to be a fluid awareness and an openness to the world. Photography can engender that, but it takes a willing participant. It takes a willing user. I find very often that by paying attention to the world through a camera, it's a deeper kind of experience than just walking around the world. If I have one more minute, studies were done when students take pictures of art in art museums. They don't remember them as well. But,
wow.
But if they actually use the camera to interact with the piece, to move around and to zoom, their memory and recall is enhanced.
Boy, that tells you a lot.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, you know, for a photographer, there's this relationship between process and thought. And for people like you and me who started off when you had to process the film and, you know, get a light meter reading and all that, process and thought were necessarily intertwined.
Right, right.
So we weren't at the point and shoot stage, at least not if we wanted to get anything good.
Well, I think the value of that freedom is that it allows you to interact with the subject. However, I think the danger of that freedom is that the device can become a source of distraction and a source of mindlessness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's up to us whether we use it mindfully or mindlessly. And the reason I wrote this book is to really engender the use of photography as a discipline that can both bring us more deeply into the world, but also give us self-awareness, self-knowledge, you know, where we have a growing relationship to how we see the world. One of the things I find notable is that we can grow to adulthood in our culture without knowing anything about our own vision, about how we see the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think photography can help address that.
You teach photography and you teach this approach through Pacific New Media. And it sounds to me as if you're teaching more about mindfulness than about this is the shutter speed, this is where you...
It's really both. You know, on Saturday I have a digital photography basics class coming up and we do address how to use the camera. People need to know the tool.
Mm-hmm.
There's a comment in Zen that you need great discipline in order to be free.
Mm-hmm.
So we really do need to learn the tools to have freedom of expression.
That statement is something that most craftspeople understand.
Right.
Discipline in order to be free.
Right, right.
You know, what a jazz musician needs to know to be able to improvise, what a photographer needs to know to be able to make quick decisions.
How could you improvise in jazz without knowing your instrument?
Well, people try, but it doesn't sound that good.
And without being attentive to the moment.
Yeah.
How can you, a ballet dancer, leap gracefully in the air without years of practice?
Well, you know, you're getting to something which is the amount of effort that to be good at anything requires that you kind of make it look easy.
Yes, yes.
But not that it be easy.
Yes.
There's a contradiction there, or at least a conflict there.
Well, one of the chapters in my book is titled Practice, and I make note of Malcolm Gladwell's statement that it takes 1,000 hours to become good at something.
10,000.
10,000 hours,
yeah,
thank you. That's correct.
I remember that, yeah.
Yes. And I'm not sure if it takes 10,000 hours, but clearly the discipline of learning the craft, whether you're using a cell phone or a regular camera, is going to give you a great deal more confidence and freedom to express what you wish or need to express.
So anyone with a cell phone in their pocket can become a photographer with some real creative output, that you shouldn't talk yourself out of it.
No, I think that everyone with a cell phone is a photographer. The question is, can we help increase some visual literacy, some awareness of the visual language? And absolutely, I think one of the most beautiful things is looking at the photographs of beginning photographers. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of authenticity, a sense of spontaneity that can get lost if people get too caught up in the equipment game or the technical process.
Yeah.
We need a balance, in other words.
Well, there's some beautiful work in this book, and I like the philosophical approach very much. Thanks very much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me, and I am teaching a class on the Zen Camera book, and we do have a free public talk tonight and a book signing,
yeah,
through Pacific New Media, which is now a standalone nonprofit, and that will be at Chaminade University tonight at 7 o'clock.
Sounds good, David. Thank you. David Ulrich's new book is called Zen Camera, Creative Awakening with a Daily Practice in Photography. That free public talk is at Chaminade's Ching Conference Center, and that's this evening at 7 p.m.
Ira Flato here, and soon I'll be there in Hawaii. Join me at First Take with Science Friday, when I'll be accompanied on stage by scientists from your community. These two science-filled evenings in Honolulu and on the Big Island are open to HPR members only. So become a member today and get your seats at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Sponsored in part by Prince Waikiki and the Hapuna Beach Resort.
4,000 Hawaii kidney disease patients are being kept alive by dialysis, but their access to the critical care they need is falling victim to bureaucracy as the state lags behind on the required certification of dialysis centers. Civil Beat reporting fellow Courtney Teague has the story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Courtney.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
This is very expensive and very, very necessary, mm-hmm, care. And mm-hmm, you know, one of my reactions in reading your piece was that dialysis patients have enough problems without without this
yeah,
one, right? What is the problem, yeah, that you describe?
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of a twofold issue, right? So here in Hawaii, kidney disease is more common than a lot of other places because we have so many residents of Asian or Pacific Islander descent who are more likely to get kidney disease.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part of the problem, like you said, is the fact that it takes the state years longer to certify these dialysis centers, which treat patients with kidney failure.
So, do I get this right? There are machines sitting in Hawaii now that are not being switched on because of this.
Yeah, just two on Oahu, but still that creates a lot of problems for patients who need to get dialysis three times per week for, mm-hmm, 4 hours, which is inconvenient enough, right?
Yeah.
But because these facilities are just kind of sitting there, only able to take a few patients, a lot of these new dialysis patients have to take these really inconvenient early morning or late night treatment time slots, which, by the way, keep in mind, there's no public transportation running late night in a lot of parts of the island.
Sure, sure.
And some patients actually have to wait in the hospital for weeks, or we've heard stories of even months being stuck in the hospital until they can get into an outpatient treatment slot. So the problem really starts at the federal level. So kind of wonky, but you have to understand that more than 8 in 10 patients on dialysis in Hawaii rely on Medicare or Medicaid, which are two government-run insurance programs. Now, basically, the feds say you can't go to any facilities that haven't received our stamp of approval. Mm-hmm. And there's only a few state inspectors that are qualified to go and do that work. So that, you know, the short-staffed health department, you know, that's a problem in and of itself. But the second problem is that the feds require the states to put dialysis centers pretty low on their priority list, which resets every year. So there have even been some years where no new dialysis centers have been inspected at all.
Courtney, what would it take to fix this?
Well, there's a new bill that's moving through the legislature right now. It does face a vote before the full House, as I recall. But that bill would appropriate funds to create new positions in the health department to inspect these facilities. The problem is it can take years for them to get this really highly specialized training to inspect new dialysis centers. But in the meantime, the governor's office and the health department are working to try and find some people on the mainland that they can bring over to perform some of these inspections.
A pretty costly solution, but it's a critical problem, isn't it? Thank you very much, Courtney.
Yeah, thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter and fellow Courtney Teague.
Week on Says You.
It's etymology, not entomology.
So that's why this kind of thing is bugging you, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's fast, it's fun, it's some of the most colorful radio on the air, Says You.
This evening at 6:30.
The Domestic Violence Center is extending its helping hand to the west side of Oahu. Nancy Creedman heads the organization. She joins us in the studio this morning to tell us more about a program called Safe on Scene, which works with the Honolulu Police Department, reaching out to those in need. Good morning, Nancy.
Good
thanks.
Morning.
Thanks
Good morning.
For joining us
yeah,
here.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about this program. How did it get started?
Well, there has been a long time need for there to be strong partnerships between the Honolulu Police Department and the programs in the community assisting families who are suffering the harm of abuse. And our conversations really gained momentum after that one incident, which became apparent after the viral video featuring Sergeant Cachola some years ago. And we spent some time talking and thinking about how we could work together to serve families in the best ways possible. So we invented Safe on Scene, and it's a really terrific way for us to bring our expertise, the Domestic Violence Action Center expertise, in collaboration with the Honolulu Police Department expertise. So when there is a domestic violence incident and a call where the police are dispatched, they will contact our Safe on Scene advocates, and we will meet them at that scene. And we provide support, crisis support, safety planning, general emotional support, practical support to the victim on the scene, while the police are then liberated to do their best work, which is with the, you know, securing the scene, conducting an investigation, taking statements, apprehending the suspect, trying to figure out how to make the scene a safe one, while we're making it possible for the survivor to think immediately about what are my next steps, how do I secure my own safety, my children's safety, if there are any. So we started in District 6 and District 7, which is the east side of Oahu, Waikiki and Punahou through Hawaii Kai.
I started out as an experiment, the program, to see, like, is this a good idea? How would we put it into effect, make it most effective? And it is a good idea, turns out. So we've obtained more funding support, Victims of Crime Act money, an appropriation from the legislature. And so recently we extended our services to D8, which is the leeward side of Oahu.
And then, so listeners understand, so this is your paid staff that is actually responding to these calls.
Correct, correct. The other thing we did recently, which is at the advice of the Honolulu Police Department, is we changed the hours of the program. We started out with the third watch, which is 2 p.m. to 11 p.m., thinking that there's maybe a high incidence after school, after work, in the evening. And what it appears is that there, as the night proceeds and darkness descends, there is greater need later in the evening. So we changed the hours from 2 to 11 to 6 p.m. to 2 a.m. so that we're really available throughout the night.
So have you already started that change?
We started that this week, Tuesday, February 20th. The first night out in D8, we received three calls.
Wow.
From the police department. And again, we are so happy to be there. It is really a gift to the police department, we think, to, like I said, liberate them from having to manage all aspects of the scene. And it's a real gift to the survivor of the incident to really have somebody who's compassionate, well-informed expertise will guide them through the next few days and possibly on their pathway to safety.
So how many staff members do you have assigned to this?
So we have three full-time staff and a supervisor currently covering D1, which is downtown to Kalihi, D7, which is Punahou to Hawaii Kai, and D8, which is Pearl City out to Waianae.
And so is this basically they're on call during those evening hours? I mean, do they work their daytime?
No. They are our full-time staff. That's their full-time job. But effectively, they're on call. When the police are called, we are called. So they are in position to respond within 30 minutes. We wanted to make that commitment to the police department so that they're not hanging around, wasting time, waiting for us to arrive. And to be practical in terms of, I mean, that each of these areas is a long, a broad geographic area. So we wanted to be practical and we wanted to be responsive and we wanted to be responsible about it.
So what type of special training do you have to get into a situation like this?
Well, all of our staff really are expected to participate in the same kind of training. Everybody has to be an expert in responding to trauma and crisis and the multifaceted challenges that face victims. So our staff participate upon hire in four full-time days of training. And then throughout the year, they're expected to participate in four additional trainings, all dedicated to understanding and deepening their understanding of the complexities of domestic violence.
So is this program modeled after something else on the mainland?
I think there are a couple of other communities that have these programs in place. We once had a program here in Hawaii, which fell off the radar in the 1990s. But we thought it was a model worth resurrecting, which is why we, began having these conversations with the police department. Our staff just did have a conference call with a community on the continent who is interested in developing a program like this. Just this week, after having read about us. So we're really happy about it. We think this is adding to the continuum of community services that families really need.
So it's just kind of reassuring then to families who might be struggling with this to know that if there a situation arises in their family that someone will be there to help if they're on the west side.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We want to know, I mean, and this is a great opportunity for me to invite people in all three of those districts, if they are encountering the police in response to a domestic violence call, they can ask the police to call our Safe on Scene advocate. If the police forget or overlook it or it doesn't seem to be happening, we invite the survivors on scene to ask the police, could you call a Safe on Scene advocate? I'd like to talk to somebody right now. Sometimes they do want to talk to us and sometimes they don't.
Right. And so you said this is a fairly new program. You've tweaked it.
Yeah.
Based on the hours and the geographic reach at this point. And then we'll see how it goes. But you said already in this first week of the launch, you've already gotten some
calls.
Well,
this is the first week of the launch in the new geographic location. We have steady calls from D7 and D1. We think it's here to stay. We hope so. Like I said, it's a pretty high intensity moment when the police are called to a scene. We made appearances at the lineups this week in D1, D7, and D8 since we changed the hours. We wanted the nighttime guys to know that the program is there and that they can call us because the daytime guys already do know that we're here.
Right, so it's education on everybody's part.
Yeah, so that they know why to call us. I mean, sometimes police get frustrated responding to domestic violence calls. Often they might go to the same address multiple times. Maybe that's because the victim didn't have the information she or he needed to make good choices. And if we can work together as partners in the community, that's going to be in everybody's best interest.
All right. Well, Nancy Creedman, thank you for being
there. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. On behalf of the families out there. Nancy Creedman is with the Domestic Violence Action Center, hoping to get the word out about how their program, Safe on Scene, is expanding to reach those in need. Find links and share your thoughts about this program with us on the Facebook page. I'm Catherine Cruz. This is The Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Adara Panetta from the University of Hawaii Manoa School of Communications. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, it's a local species of water bird that once almost went extinct in our islands. In the 1960s, scientists estimated there were fewer than 60 of them left. The numbers have bounced back somewhat, but the birds are still considered endangered. A number of factors contributed to the decline in their numbers, including loss of wetland habitat and predation from introduced animals. Ancient Hawaiians believed their cry, when heard at night, was an omen of death. Their red frontal shield was believed in ancient legend to have been created by fire, and they are believed to have brought fire to the people from the gods. In Hawaiian, they were called alae ula, and in English, they were known as the Hawaiian gallinule.
And we have a winner, Marcus Feigla of Honolulu, got it right. It was a very popular quiz, lots of bird fans. And that is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's new Career Center, helping students to explore careers, understand education requirements, and get localized data on salary and jobs. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
When you leave a tip at a restaurant, who gets the money? Is it shared equally among waitstaff and so-called back-of-house workers? We asked Clayton Kumita, president and CEO of the Hawaii's Employers Council, to explain how tip pooling works today and to explain why the council wants the rules that govern tip pooling changed.
Right now, well, there's different kinds of tip pools. There's a tip pool where you just have the wait staff and the busboys, the front of the house staff, the customer-facing people participate. They'll pool their tips. There's also a tip pool where you involve the kitchen staff, the what they call the back of the house staff. So that would be the cooks, dishwashers, expediters, people like that. Mm-hmm. So right now, under the current rules, the department, Federal Department of Labor, has said you can't have a tip pool that includes the back of the house staff.
Yeah.
You can only have a tip pool that includes the customer-facing front of the house staff.
Which creates quite an income disparity for front of the house, back of the house.
Oh, it certainly does. The back of the house makes a lot less than the front of the house staff.
So the Department of Labor has asked the public to weigh in on whether or not they'd like to see that provision changed. Is that right?
That's correct. They're looking for comments from restaurants, looking for comments from employees.
What kind of comments are they getting?
Well, I think from the employer side, what the employers, the restaurants are in favor of it. So what this rule really does is it takes us back to the state of affairs, state of the law that existed before 2011 when the new rules came out. And those rules are what the Department of Labor is proposing to take back, rescind. And back before 2011, you could run a tip pool where you could ask your employees to tip out the front of the house staff, ask the front of the house staff to tip out to the back of the house staff. So everybody would be happier. There'd be more morale. There's a sense of teamwork. And the idea is that everybody who contributes to the restaurant experience, you know, participates in the bounty from the customer's tips. And I think restaurants would like to see that. From the employee side, I think I think a lot of employees, at least front of the house staff, really believe that it's fair to tip out the back of the house staff, because if the food is cold, if the dishes are dirty, they're not going to get a good tip.
Sure.
A lot of groups, particularly employee unions, those kinds of things, they're saying that, well, they're against it because there's a possibility that employer may confiscate or take some of the tips that the employers are getting and pocket them rather than redistributing them to the back of the house staff.
How would they go about doing that?
Well, it's kind of complicated. Under the regulations, if I could give a brief history of the regulations,
please.
I think that would be helpful. So before 2011, there was no regulation that limited who could participate in a tip pool except where the employer is taking the federal tip credit. And what the tip credit is it allows an employer to pay less than the minimum wage so long as the employee receives enough in tips to bring them up to at least the minimum wage or above the minimum wage. So what the federal law said was if you tick, as an employer, a tip credit, paid your employee less than the federal minimum wage, then what you had to do was allow the employee to keep all of the tips, allow the employees to keep all of the tips, except that you could run a tip pool that included only front of the house staff, so only the wait staff, the bussers, the bartenders.
So that's where the distinction front of the house, back of the house came in.
Right.
A federal regulation.
Through a federal regulation. It wasn't the statute. The Department of Labor believed that the Department of Labor actually went beyond what the statute said in limiting who could participate in a tip pool regardless of whether you took the tip credit. So the reason it's a little complicated is in Hawaii, we can't take the federal tip credit. In Hawaii, we have to pay a minimum wage of $10.10. There is a state tip credit, but in order to take the state tip credit, you can pay 75 cents less than the $10.10 minimum wage so long as your employees are receiving at least $7.75 per hour in tips. So you pay $9.35 instead of $10.10, but your employee has to make at least $7.75 per hour in tips in order for you to take that 75 cent tip credit.
That is complicated.
Yeah. Yes.
At the same time, you've got a situation where that a lot of people would like to see change in Hawaii, right?
I believe so. I think for the restaurant community, the hospitality industry, they'd like to be able to reward their back of the house staff. And again, it's because everybody usually contributes to the dining experience.
Well, the somewhat convoluted way that the federal regulation came about sounds as if it was not designed to be punitive toward the back of the house, but it sort of came out that way. Is that a fair description?
I think it is. I think the Department of Labor was really trying to limit the ability of employers to control how tips are distributed, and it ended up it ended up being punitive towards the back of the house staff.
But it didn't come really from the restaurant associations, restaurant managers. They didn't really look to make that distinction. It was part of a federal regulation. That's the way I'm
right.
interpreting
well,
it.
Well, again, this is the causal relationship is kind of complicated. What happened was there was a suit that the Ninth Circuit decided in 2010 called Cumby versus Woody Wu.
Uh-huh.
That involved a waitress, Misty Wu, who worked. Misty Cumby, who worked at an Oregon restaurant, and in Oregon, you can't take a tip credit. So she was paid the full federal wage, full Oregon minimum wage, which is higher than the federal minimum. But she was required to pay out a little more than 50% of the tips she received to the back of the house staff. So at the end of her shift, all of the staff had to tip out the back of the house staff, and the employer actually made them pay out approximately more than 50%. So she filed a suit, and the Ninth Circuit heard the suit and said, well, you know, the federal tip credit statute does limit tip pools, but only if you take the federal tip credit. And if there's no federal tip credit being taken, the employer can decide to require you to tip out the back of house staff with 50% or more of your tips. There's nothing in the statute that prevents employers from doing that.
Her argument in that particular case being, hey, it's my money, it was put in my hand, now you're taking it out of my hand.
Sure, yes. It's unfair. That should have been my property. I should have been able to retain it. So in response to that, the Department of Labor passed this regulation in 2011 saying no, tips are the property of the employee, regardless of whether the employer takes a federal tip credit, and you can only run a tip pool that involves the front of the house staff.
So it's really the back of the house staff and a general sort of equity among restaurant employees that's the goal here of those who are asking the Department of Labor to change the regulation.
Yes, the restaurant industry really, you know, on a national level and on a local level, really would like to be able recognize the back of the house staff and, you know, have them participate in the customer's tips.
Clayton Kamita is the president and CEO of the Hawaii Employers Council.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. The CMH Ensemble and the UH Chamber Singers perform Baroque music of Monteverdi and Cavalli, March 2nd at the Lutheran Church of Honolulu. ChamberMusicHawaii.org.
A lot of different activities going on throughout the state. Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at some of the events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. And we have an event tomorrow at UH Manoa discussing the language revival taking place worldwide.
Yes, it's called the Ho'olauleʻa of Knowledges, and the keynote speaker is Sir Timothy Karetu. He is a champion of language revitalization in New Zealand and also a mentor here in Hawaii and around the world. This event features a panel discussion as well as entertainment by people like Robert Casimiro, Aaron J. Salah, Snowbird Bento and a great duo from Kauai, Kupawa. It's from 4 to 8 p.m. at UH Manoa's Andrews Amphitheater, and it's free on top of that.
That's quite a lineup.
Yeah, it
I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And tomorrow night on Maui, there's an update about the restoration of Ko'olawe.
That's right. Paul Higashino is restoration manager for the Ko'olawe Island Reserve Commission, and I'll talk about what's being done with planting and erosion control. He'll give the big picture for natural resource management and highlight new projects currently underway on the island. This is happening tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Hannibal Tavares Community Center in Pukalani on Maui.
Now, I know Ko'olawe funding is a big issue, and I think they've got bills that are being heard this week to deal with that. And what's this about a book sale on Kauai starting tomorrow?
Okay, that's the Friends of the Lihue Public Library. They're hosting their spring used book sale beginning tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and that runs through Sunday. Besides books, DVDs and CDs will also be on sale. And once again, this is happening at the Lihue Public Library starting tomorrow and running through Sunday.
You can always get good deals over
always,
there.
Yes.
Always at those library book sales. All right, thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation, taking a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. And you can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Eggs, check. Milk, check. Going grocery shopping with a list in hand is an age-old way to be efficient. But what about bringing checklists beyond the supermarket?
If those checklists had not been integrated to that level at the start of World War II, it's reasonable to assume that many hundreds and probably thousands of lives would have been lost.
The life-saving power of the checklist. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll have a panel show about youth empowerment with students who are adding their voices to the national debate around gun violence.
Tell us what you think or suggest an idea. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Or you can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation. This program and all our past ones are available on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.